What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Paula Poundstone was one of our first and all-time favorite guests on the big event, dropping by last year before her show on New Year's Eve. I feel like we covered about one-fifth of what I wanted to ask, and she said she had a good time, so I was thrilled when she agreed to come back. Paula Poundstone is our first returning celebrity guest on the podcast. I want to warn you now, as I did the last time, the majority of the big event episodes are clean, but this is going to be an explicit podcast with swearing, starting now. Here's Paula Poundstone talking about a recent comedy gig in Arlington, Virginia, where a plainclothes nun showed up in one of the front rows of the theater and took notice of Paula's use of profanity.
So as soon as she said it, I was like, I said, oh my gosh, and how many times have I said fuck now?
Yeah.
And she said five. And so for a while I would like turn, like every time I cursed, I would turn to her and say sorry. And then at the end of the show, unbidden, if that's the right word, you know, I mean, I hadn't asked her to do this, and I hadn't talked to her directly in quite a while by the end of the show, because she felt like a bit of a wild card for me,
yeah.
And I didn't want the show to get away from me with this lady sort of taking over. But at the very end of the show, she stood up, and before she wasn't standing, she just talked.
Yeah.
But at the very end, she stood up, she turned, she faced the audience, and she told them how many times I had said shit and how many times I had said fuck.
Poundstone returns to San Francisco in a couple of weeks for another New Year's Eve performance at the Norse Theater, now called the Sidney Goldstein Theater, after the dynamo creator of City Arts and Lectures, who died earlier this year. We talk about her first New Year's Eve gigs in San Francisco, why she likes performing in SF now more than ever, and her 1980s job as a bike messenger in the city. Second warning, Paula Poundstone was very funny from the moment we started the sound check, so I decided to include that in the episode. This one starts very abruptly. We're your concierge for culture in the Bay Area. I'm Peter Hartlob, and this is The Big Event.
Mussolini. They took his body. I'm sure you know this part. They took his body down to like a town square.
Yeah.
And they hung up him and the other cohorts. And people hit them with sticks. I mean, they were dead. Didn't matter.
Yeah.
But people hit them with sticks and peed on them and at things like that. And they abused Mussolini's corpse to such a degree that his brains fell out the back of his head.
Wow.
And I have only one source on this, which is a book that I read recently called Mussolini, The Last 600 Days.
Uh-huh.
And a quick-thinking partisan scooped up his brains and put them in a jar.
Uh-huh.
And somewhere along the way, he contacts, or they contact, Mussolini's widow. And they say, we have Mussolini's brains in a jar. Would you like to have them? And she said, and again, I only have this one source, which is Mussolini, The Last 600 Days. She said, I live in a really small house. I don't know where I would put them. I just think, oh, no, because here we are in this archival place. I just thought that would be a good question to ask the librarian.
Paula Poundstone, that is the greatest sound check in podcasting history. Welcome to the big event. Welcome to the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much. So I'm really the first return guest?
You're the first
return. Maybe fudged that a little bit.
First return guest who doesn't work here.
Yeah.
So if you worked in the building, you would not be the first return guest. You are the first.
You've had them over and over.
I've had them over and over. I think I've only had Durst once, although Will Durst, Heather Knight, the San Francisco City Hall columnist, and I rode every Muni bus in one day earlier this year.
Oh, wow.
And Will Durst was our celebrity driver. There was one point where we had to get from like the Mission District to West Portal, and we didn't want to take a bus because we had to do this in a small period of time. So
yeah.
Will Durst came and picked us up, And we picked him and Art Agnes to be our celebrity drivers because we knew they wouldn't push anything political. Art's not running for anything. And we knew they would know city streets and probably drive like cabbies, like New York cabbies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I can speak for Thirsty. He's been here for quite a while. I love his wife.
Oh, Debbie, she's delightful. She came here too.
She's such a great person. This year I went to the, for the first time in many years, I was able to make it to Comedy Day in Golden Gate Park.
You were?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
fantastic. And I just had a blast. And I mean, the audience was wonderful, and that's the main reason that I had a blast. But I wouldn't have had that. It's Debbie Durst.
Yeah.
She's just so much fun. And all the people that help put it together. Apparently they've been doing. They've had the same volunteers for many years, which is a good sign about their leader, everybody's just sort of knows what to do. And all day long, she's saying stuff like, "That's great, you're the best."
I saw her and Will. She was the MC at Cobb's. I think it was still called Cobb's, but it was the old Cobb's, of course, in the 80s, probably 87, 88.
There's been about 10 old Cobb's.
Yeah.
Cobb's has reinvented itself several times.
And I was like 16, 17, but they let underage people in, except I would have to order two drinks, so I would order two mineral waters, figuring that was like the most mature drink you could order. I would still look mature, but not be getting a real drink.
Oh, yeah, that's very mature.
And I remember Debbie Durst brought Will Durst in piggyback. And then he did a political, and I'd never heard of political comedy. I mean, Mort Saul was gone by then, so I didn't know what was happening. It blew me away. He was absolutely hilarious, and he still is. I saw him this year.
Oh, nice.
But, we're not talking about your New Year's show.
Oh, we got to. I'm New Year's at the Sydney Goldstein
Theater.
Which is the Norse Theater.
It's the Norse Theater.
And I was there last year and had a great time, and it is the best way, I think, to kick out 2018, and I don't know if you want to say welcome in 2019.
Yeah.
I gotta say, you know, for years I've either tweeted or somehow promoted my New Year's show as saying, you know, let's, you know, welcome in the new year with a certain amount of optimism. I have to say, I have less optimism this year. I still think it's important to laugh, very important to laugh, but I think that we need to. In fact, we need to laugh perhaps more than ever, because I think it's going to be a raggedy-ass year.
You think 2019 will be worse than 2018?
Yeah, and I honestly, maybe, you know, because I grew up watching Guy Lombardo really thinking that the fact that you're moving to a new year had some sort of transitional merit in your life.
Yeah.
Like, I used to think you were supposed to kiss someone and cry on New Year's. I thought it was like some sort of emotional, that's really the drinking that was leading to that, not real life. But that was sort of the way it was always handled, was it made a big difference and that you were somehow going to feel different and it was a new page and blah, blah, blah. I don't think that anymore. But I actually believed it for the longest time that there was somehow something bright ahead of us. I walked by a store last night. It might have been a Sonoma Williams. I can't swear to it, but it had like holiday decorations. I was walking my dog. It had holiday decorations, and it said, "Wishing you a happy moment." I think it was wishing you a happy moment, which I thought was brilliant, because you know what. That's great. Low expectations are the key to happiness. So a happy moment. Okay. I feel like we can promise that.
Yeah.
But it may end there. But we need to be fortified with laughter, I think.
Do you think about
forward.
That? Do you think like my responsibility is getting larger and larger as a comedian to give people a night out where they're having a good time and forgetting about stuff?
I think much more selfishly than that. It's good for me.
Yeah.
A night of laughter is just, you just feel so damn good. And I have to say, I've like anybody else, you know, life has its ups and downs. But, you know, I go to my job in a variety of emotional places over the years, right? I've been doing this for 39 years. And I can honestly say that maybe with the exception of a handful of times when maybe I've bombed or thing, you know, outside of that, which has only happened a handful of times in my life, thank goodness, every single time, I do feel uplifted by the experience. I feel it's a very renewing job. And thank goodness, because, you know, the travel and then responsibilities at home and promotion and stupid social networking and all that, are exhausting.
Yeah.
But I happen to do a job that is renewing. I mean, if I was a coal miner, which, A, I don't have the skills for, but if I were trained to do it, I would be exhausted, but I wouldn't be renewed.
We talked last time you were here, we talked a lot
about
coal mining and your years in San Francisco as a comedian. And was there a point then when you're at the other cafe, you're at the Holy City Zoo, how close did you come to not being a full-time comedian? Was that ever an option? And
oh, by that time, no, not so much. I mean, I had day jobs when I lived here.
Like
I was
what?
A bicycle messenger. I worked behind the counter at the other cafe. I was at one point, I was a temporary worker back when there was such a thing. Remember
yeah.
when there were temp
oh, yeah.
places?
I remember temp agencies.
Yeah, I worked for a temp agency. And during the time that I worked at a temp agency, I worked one day at Blue Cross Blue Shield. And yes, you should be afraid. And for, I don't know, weeks or months, I can't remember, maybe weeks, I worked at the warehouse of a department store that's probably not even there anymore. I've forgotten
yeah.
now. Returning items to the shelf that had been, it was after the holidays. It was incredibly depressing. But I worked with my friend Joe Campiolo, who put a word in for me at the temp place. And Joe was, eventually he called himself, what's the name of the comic he used to call himself? Dexter Madison.
Okay.
But his real name. And prior to his Dexter Madison performances, he was Joe Campiolo, one of the funniest guys ever and in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Truly original. I don't think he works anymore, but he's
yeah.
fantastic.
Bicycle messenger.
Yeah, I was a bicycle messenger.
What was that like?
I mean, it was horrible.
I bike commute to work here, and I think I'm like the dumbest 48-year-old guy. You know, I'm going to die. That's how I'm going to die, is riding my bike into the Chronicle. I live in Alameda, and I take the ferry, and I put my bike on the ferry and then ride from
wow.
the ferry building here, and it's like Mad Max Fury Road every time I come in.
Well, for listeners who don't know, he's in fantastic shape.
Oh,
so
you.
It's if you fall, you'll probably recover quickly.
Okay.
Because, you know, you got that going for you. You know, they're not going to find like, oh, they're not going to go in because of the fall and find like, oh, his ticker's bad.
Yeah.
So it's been beneficial in some way. It was a terrible job being a bike messenger. I'm not a great bike rider. I was too weak to ride up a hill and too scared to ride down a hill. So I mostly pushed and they had these lousy bikes. I remember one time we had like a meeting, you know, one of those employee meetings they make
yeah.
you go to. And I remember one of the employees complaining that they got their bikes from the Salvation Army. I mean, why would they buy fancy bikes? They weren't going to do that. I mean, they weren't like bikes with speeds or anything. They were just like single speed, no fancy dancing. But they had baskets, you know, like on the front handlebars.
Yeah.
They had a basket, and mostly what we carried were blueprint copies, which are rolled up. So it's like, you know, like a really, really heavy thing of wrapping paper. That's what it's like.
Yeah.
And you know, you put two or three, so it sticks off the end of the of the basket. I mean, they don't fit in the basket. You would strap them sort of with bungees. You'd strap them onto the basket. They weren't in the basket. And, you know, you might travel with, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 of those.
Yeah.
And so the bike was always ready to go down and lose balance. So it was a horrible job.
Yeah.
But I did it.
You did it.
I did it. I did it so that I could do stand-up comedy at night.
But it was fun, right? Do you look back at that time as being a fun period, or do you look back at it as being hard and
well, the part of
uncertain.
The part of being the I'll tell you what, I bumped into Durst downtown one time because there was a bunch of us, all the open micers and the people, we were all open micers back then. You know, we would get the occasional paid job, but largely we were open micers, and we were really low on the totem pole, and We sort of traveled in a pack a lot of times because none of us had cars.
Mm-hmm.
We all, if one person had a car, then you really counted on them to drive you to another open mic night. And so Durst was one of my buddies, and this is very soon after I got to town. I bumped into him. He was working someplace downtown. There used to be a place called maybe Wims or Vims or something. What's the street? Is it Kearney that comes to a point?
Zim's Hamburger?
No, I don't think it was Zim's. No,
right.
It was like Wims or something.
All right.
I don't think it was. But there was a place that came to a point, and this little diner was on the end of the point. And Durst and I used to meet there for lunch occasionally. We were both dodging our day job,
mm-hmm.
taking more time than we were supposed to. There were blueprints that weren't getting delivered because I was sipping a soda there with Durst. But anyway, so that the day job working part, I don't remember fondly at all. But it was like I lived two different lives. The nighttime of cruising around with these other comics and standing in the back of the room waiting to go on, and the sheer joy of telling jokes that you think are funny and experiencing people laugh at them. And it was there was a wildly experimental vibe about stand-up back then, where people really trying to do some different stuff, trying to not be exactly like the guy that went on just before them, and that was fun.
I look back, and I dig around this archive. We're in this basement archive right now. And whenever I look at comedy bills from like 1984 to 87 or 8, it's like every name is someone I recognize. I'm looking right now, I was looking at New Year's shows, past New Year's shows. And you had one at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater with Dana Carvey, Paula Poundstone, Bobby Slayton, and the host was Rob Schneider.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a night. One of the things that stands out to me about that is that there were four acts anyways.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people. Like, nowadays, I don't... one of the things... none of us had that much time.
Yeah.
So even though we were the big New Year's headliners, I don't... If you had 30 good minutes, or 20 good minutes... sometimes that's as far as you could go and still be good. Not Dana necessarily, but for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Dana could go on forever with no jokes at all.
Yeah, you knew him pretty well. Did you stay at his house?
We were roommates, yeah.
We talked about it last time. We have a photo of you on a trampoline, I think.
And that's right.
Somehow that trampoline was connected to Dana Carvey.
Yeah, it was in the backyard at the house that I shared with Dana Carvey.
That
was a fun time. Dana has achieved great things because Dana's great.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm really good at my job of being a stand-up comic. But I'm never going to be like a big movie star or a big star of anything. Because I've been doing stand-up comedy for 39 years, I've had a lot of waves wash over my rocks by now. And I can deliver pretty good. But it was clear that Dana was just going to be huge.
Yeah.
As he was, he is.
I listen to your podcast.
Thank
nobody,
you.
Nobody listens to Paula Poundstone.
That's right.
I guess I'm the listener. I'm enjoying it. Jesse Thorne is, I heard the Jesse Thorne episode.
Oh, yeah.
He's like a podcasting Yoda, except he's like 28 years old. He's helped me out and helped out everybody who wants help with podcasting.
Yeah, he sort of saw the he saw the possibility of podcasting, I think, before other people.
Yeah, he's the head of Maximum Fun, and you had a podcast on NPR, and that was kind of short lived. And then I like this one way better. It seems
like it fits your comedy. The original one was live from the Poundstone Institute, and we did it in front of a live audience, which is costly. And basically, the endowment costs were killing us. We did it. It was all NPR engineers, and it was an expensive show. And what we do now is dirt cheap. We are in a studio in North Hollywood, in a section. I mean, all of North Hollywood isn't bad by any means, but we are on a stretch that is like the forgotten. It's the early part of Armageddon.
Uh-huh.
There's mattresses out on the street. There's toilets on the street. One day I get out of the car and I stepped in some sort of waste, and I'm still just praying it was dog waste. But it's possible that it wasn't. And so one of our producers had a similar experience. I'm sure I've seen drug deals done right before my eyes. It's a really nasty section of town. And there we are in this little studio there. It's me, Adam Felber, who I met doing Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and is a good friend of our family and has been for years. And we bring on a couple of people per show usually to have some information that we can have fun with, basically. We call it a comedy advice podcast.
It's not a celebrity thing. Like, you'll have someone who deals with plumbing and talk about all the funny things that they found in the toilet, which is great material. I'm not making it sound funny, but that's a good 15 minutes of comedy.
Well, it's fun because you're getting real information. I mean, my original idea, I wanted to do a show about how to move out of your parents' house so that you learned all the stuff that you need to know to function as an adult, which, by the way, I still don't know. I, for example, had a situation not too long ago. My son, although I begged him not to, when he became an adult, he went out and got credit cards like an idiot.
Oh, yeah.
And I told him, don't do it. Don't do that. That's a stupid idea. And what I thought he had done was run up huge bills with money that he didn't have. It turns out that's not what he did. What he did was run up small bills with money that he didn't have. But what happens is they just keep dinging you when you don't pay it. And the next thing you know, you're screwed. I never knew that. Yeah. I didn't know that because I have never once in my life not paid my credit card bill. It never occurred to me not to pay my credit card bill, whereas it was the first thought in my son's head. But my point is, there's lots of things that I don't know anything about. I have no idea how to read my phone bill.
Yeah. Mm.
So my original idea was that, you know, you learn to move out of your parents' house, which we're doing for the rest of our lives. It's not like, you know, it all happens one day. But we sort of, so that's why I wanted people, although it would be fun to talk to celebrities too, but that the original idea was just the stuff that you need to know to function.
Yeah.
So we had a lady come talk. She has a business where they help you eradicate mold from your house. She was so much fun.
Yeah.
She was so enthusiastic about finding mold. You know, the bad kind of mold, the kind where you go on the mold registry where you're judged. And by the way, I do have mold in my ceiling. It's not my house. I rent.
Yeah.
But in fact, I got to say, I had told my landlord that I thought I had mold in my on my ceiling. And so she came and took a look, and she's kind of a classic cheap landlord.
Mm-hmm.
And she always sends her nephew Nick to fix things. And poor Nick is this bedeviled guy that doesn't know how to fix anything.
Uh-huh.
And he always, he's very apologetic. Like, I don't know, she must have naked pictures of him or something. He really doesn't want to do this job, but he'll come and he'll go, oh, I don't know. I don't know. Like, oh, jeez. So she bring, you know, like a Nick or another nephew. And they look at the ceiling. There's mold there. You can see it's black mold.
That's not good, Paula.
It's not good. Yeah. It's like the stuff in the second Spider-Man. You know, it's like the black stuff that made him bad.
Yeah.
And that hurt Topher. What's
Grace.
His name? Grace, yeah.
That's the third Spider-Man. I don't want to.
Oh, was it? Okay,
just
thanks.
In case any of our listeners go out and rent it, I don't want
you
them
know
to
they will
be
too.
Thrown off.
And they'll complain. All right, so yeah, it was a third Spider-Man. So there's terrible black stuff. There it was on my ceiling of my walk-in closet. And so I brought it. She looked at it, and she bleached it. That's what she did. She said, oh, you have to bleach. So she bleaches it. And so you don't see it anymore. And so now I have this mold expert on my show. And I said, what are you supposed to do with mold? She said, well, people think you bleach it. That's the number one rule. Don't bleach it.
Oh, no.
So she's so we bring on people that can be informative and at the same time that is really a fun playground for jokes.
Yeah.
And we make jokes. That's what we do. And it's fun. Adam says all he cares about is making enough money to buy some beers.
Uh-huh.
And fortunately, all I care about is making enough money for Adam to buy some beers.
Okay.
So it's not a high profit thing. But,
no.
In fact, it may be a financial loss. But it is really fun to do, and I hope that people will listen to Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone.
Yeah, very funny. You mentioned that you had nuns at your show recently.
I did. I had a nun in the front row in Alexandria, Virginia. And Very in the beginning of the show, I don't, you know, I often say to people, "What do you do for a living?" You know, I often say, "Where are you from? What do you do?" I didn't even get that far in the show before this woman in the front row announced that she was a nun. And as soon as she said
it... So she's not wearing a habit. This is like dead man walking plain clothes nun.
Right. Yeah. Very much like a dead man walking, not very much like that. And so as soon as she said it, I was like, I said, "Oh my gosh, and how many times have I said fuck now?"
Yeah.
And she said five. And so for a while I would every time I cursed, I would turn to her and say sorry. And then at the end of the show, unbidden, if that's the right word, you know, I mean, I asked her to do this, and I hadn't talked to her directly in quite a while by the end of the show, because she felt like a bit of a wild card for me, and I didn't want the show to get away from me with this lady sort of taking over. But at the very end of the show, she stood up, and before she wasn't standing, she just talked. Yeah. But at the very end of the show, she stood up, she turned, she faced the audience, and she told them how many times I had said shit and how many times I had said fuck, which I thought was really funny. And she meant it to be funny.
And she said the words, or did she go S word and F word?
Oh, no, she said the words.
Oh.
And, and by the way, she didn't come there to damn me to hell or to tell me that, you know, I was doing Satan's work. I mean, she came because she's entertained by my shows. I actually, believe it or not, have a fair amount of clergy at my show.
Really?
Yeah, and the only reason I know that is because I do, it's not exactly a scientific survey, but I do a lot of, you know, where you from, what do you do for a living? And that's why I know. People say, well, I'm not. What I get a lot is Episcopalian minister.
Yeah.
I get a lot of that. I think Episcopalian is very oddly religion light. It's people who get together in the same building, but I think that it's a little. There's some vagaries to the Christian religion, but I think it's a little vague.
Yeah, I don't want to stereotype, but what's the best religious figure to have in the audience for comedy? Do the Catholics laugh more than the?
I'm not certain. I've had the occasional priest, and of course the occasional nun. No one has ever identified themselves as a born-again Christian to me, but I can guarantee you I would have a blast with that.
Yeah.
But maybe the born-agains don't come to me for just that reason.
Do you ever get celebrities? Do you ever see someone out in the audience and go, wait, I know you, you're so-and-so on...
No, but I just also, in Alexandria, when I was doing the meet-and-greet afterwards... Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, I look up, you know, when I'm doing it, after my shows, I usually, I have t-shirts. In fact, I have a remarkably soft tri-poly blend shirt with a self-portrait on the left breast and a memorable quote on the back that I'm very proud of.
What's the quote?
I've forgotten the quote, even though it's memorable. It's something about how much I talk. But I sell those things, and I always tell people, you don't have to buy anything at all to come up and say hello or get an autograph or a hug or a photograph. So I do close to an additional hour just talking to people after the show. And so I was standing out in the lobby in Alexandria, Virginia, doing just that, and I look up, and there's Mark Shields and Mark Russell. I had not seen them in the crowd. I would have loved. And I'm pretty sure, in fact, I wonder what I had said that night. When I'm in the D.C. area, I'm more likely to talk about not just politics, but the specific broadcasts that I watch, which is I watch a lot of MSNBC, and my favorite broadcast is the NewsHour. And I'll sort of make, because you figure if people live in the D.C. area, they're paying attention to this stuff, you know. So, hold on. Speaking of broadcasting, there's my phone. Hold on.
No problem.
Yeah. I don't know who that. I think it's
not.
I think it's the person who dropped me off. I think.
Uh oh. You answer. Go ahead and answer
okay,
it.
Okay, hold on.
This is good radio.
Hello. Oh, I think I'm too late.
I want to mention this is a flip phone. Paula.
Yeah. I think it's the person that's driving me around today, because I have somebody driving me, because I came in from the airport and I've gone to a couple different press places.
Yeah.
And I think it's her probably saying that I'm about to miss something. I don't care.
Mark Shields and Mark Russell.
Mark Shields and Mark Russell were there. What I started to say was because I hope I didn't say anything bad about the NewsHour because I love the NewsHour. And that's really where I've seen Mark Shields on other things. Yeah. But my favorite night of the week is Friday night. Ugh, now the phone's going to keep making that noise. My favorite night of the week on the NewsHour is Friday night because they do Shields and Brooks.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge Mark Shields fan. So yeah, and Mark Russell, honestly, I've seen a few minutes of him here and there, but he used to do those. In fact, I think he used to do like a New Year's special on on PBS.
Yeah.
And I had never.
Well, you're working on New Year's.
That's exactly right.
Norse Auditorium/Sydney Goldstein Theater.
Right, on New Year's, which is a Tuesday night
in San Francisco.
December 31st, San Francisco. I'm so lucky the last years I come to San Francisco at least annually, and for the last maybe 15 years, that's been like at least in the month of December, if not New Year's, and it's a fun time to be here.
Is that deliberate that you do your, because I actually tracked it. Archive
you're
guy,
like a data journalist,
I am,
man.
A data journalist. I actually went year by year to see where you were. You were here throughout the 80s, and then through, I think, 92, and then you were gone for a while, and then you came back in 2015. You did a Christmas show for a while around
there. Yeah, I did. I used to do the Palace of Fine Arts.
Yeah, and then you started doing New Year's again a few years ago. I'm sure you could do a New Year's show anywhere. What brought you here?
You know, I have done New Year's shows other places. I was in, where was it? I think Mesa, Arizona for a number of years for New Year's. And it's a fine job, and Mesa, Arizona is a lovely place, and I much prefer to be, I don't know, for New Year's in San Francisco. It just feels right. I don't know. If I had my choice, I don't always have a choice, but if I had my choice, here's where I want to be.
What else do you do while you're here? Is anything left from that makes you feel like San Francisco back in the old days, or is everything new?
I mean, occasionally I've seen my old roommate, and because when I first came here, I lived in the Richmond, and then eventually I moved into my first 3 places. You know what's weird? When I look back on my time in San Francisco, which on a timeline is not all that long, that I actually lived here, but it has such a big place in my memory. I think part of it was they were such formative years, you know. But, you know, and plus I lived in like 5 different places, which means I lived them about 3 months at a time.
Sure.
But I ended up in an apartment on Hyde Street, right where the cable car goes by.
Yeah.
Couple blocks up from the pier. And so occasionally I stop by there still.
Nice.
But it's been a while. Yeah. My roommate's still there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Still there. Yeah. Well, it's the golden handcuff when you got that rent control. Your roommate's probably paying $300 a month. You can't move.
Oh, I think she bought it.
Oh, she bought it.
I think she owns that apartment.
Oh, wow. That's even better.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, yeah. It's not. And it's really nice. It's nice. If you sit in the front window. Now, when I lived there, I lived in like what must have at one time been like a maid's quarters.
Yeah.
Because there was a bathroom down there with a shower. But the room itself, the way you would have gotten to it was either coming up from the garage of this apartment building, and you went through these windy wooden steps in the dark, which was a little difficult with luggage. Or the other way you could enter, and that used a key, the other way you could enter was off the balcony of the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
If you walked down the end of the balcony, there was a window that that this room had.
Yeah.
And so we used to go in and out that window all the time. That's how we... And, you know, when I first moved
in there...
It's like
a Dukes of Hazzard thing was...
I never saw the Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, but they would climb in the... And I'm not endorsing the show by any means, but they would go through the window. They didn't have a door. It was welded shut. So
they'd
jump through the window there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I detoured you. For those who watch, it sounds like it is very similar architecturally. So... When I first moved in, you know, you couldn't help but feel that anybody could come through that window. It felt a little scary sometimes. And I was down. I wasn't in the main part of the apartment. I was sort of down in the bowels, and it was a little dark and scary sometimes. So I first moved in, and my roommate, right away, she gave me what they used to call panic button, which they had an alarm system. And she says, you know, keep this down there. And, you know, if anything happens, you push this button, it activates the alarm. I'm like, great. So I've always slept on the floor. And so, you know, I before I go to sleep at night, I put the thing beside me on the floor. And this is how I was able to sleep, with the comfort of knowing I had this panic button beside
me. And we should mention, this is the Zodiac Killer still walking around. For people who are younger, there was a literal serial killer sending notes to the Chronicle saying he was going to kill people by crawling through their windows during this period. So I'm sorry, Paul.
There may have been good reason to feel sad. So one day, my roommate and I were going to have breakfast together, so I come up out of the bowels of my room. I come through the window. I come through the kitchen door. And I still have the panic button in my hand. It was on a chain. And she goes, what is that? This is after years of living there. She said, what is that? And I said, oh, it's the alarm button. She goes, oh, we canceled that years ago.
Oh, no.
So I'd been using the Dumbo's feather security system.
Well, I'm glad you're okay.
Yeah, I managed. That's an upbeat story in that way.
Yeah, it's a triumph of human spirit. All right, I got two more things because Jesse or whoever is going to call again. First of all, and tell me if it's rude, but you brought out a flip phone that was so old school.
I have a flip phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just wanted to ask you about it. I wanted to get a closer look, get the model. Do you prefer that?
I do.
Yeah.
You know, the truth is I have an iPhone as well, but I don't talk on that iPhone. And the iPhone is a 3, I think. What do they call that? It's a 3. And guess what? I bought it the day before the 4 came out.
Got it.
Yeah. So I'm fairly unusual in that regard.
You don't have to get it out. Leave the phone. Leave the phone where it is.
What the hell I did with the phone?
That's all right. We can't leave that here. But so that's like a bat phone. That's like your bat phone.
What do you mean?
You know, the Batman had the bat phone that Commissioner Gordon could call him on.
Oh, yeah.
This is like
a
second phone.
This flip phone, I found out, you guys. This flip phone is the one that I talk on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the one that I tell people this is my cell phone number. The other one I don't use for talking. I don't like talking into an iPhone.
Yeah.
Besides which, it has so many other tasks to do. The only reason I have that stupid iPhone is for tweeting.
Yeah.
Really. Because when I have a thought, I like to put it up on goofy, stupid Twitter, and you see how far along that's moved all of our lives. Don't you think there's a certain delicious irony, if you were the bad guy in this case, to the fact that it's social networking that is how the Russians have attacked us?
Yeah. No, I didn't see that coming. I mean, everybody loved social networking a few years ago. They made the social network. It was like... Yeah.
It's so America. It's so, you know, the idea that we're all reading shit on our things and, you know, just falling for it right in line. I always want to say to Trump supporters that you're welcome back.
Yeah.
You know, that this guy, he's a con artist and he's good at it. And he was in league with other con artists that are really good at it. And... come back, you know, just don't worry about it. Nobody's going to make fun of you. It happened. It was a thing. Now.
Reset.
Now, now let's go be Republicans and Democrats again. And we don't have to. The idea that, you sort of judge everybody and chastise them because they fell for something. You know, the truth is, when I was in Africa one time, I was conned out of money. Really, actually, more than once.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but because there were a lot of, I don't know if there still are, but there at the time where there were a lot of people that really worked over the tourists.
Sure.
And what's funny is when I went to Africa, I bought this shirt that had like a zippered pocket because I was very worried about pickpockets.
Yeah.
But when the person got the money from me, they didn't bump into me and take it out of my pocket. They talked me into taking it out of my pocket and handing it to them. And I did it, and I felt like an idiot, and I was really, like, ashamed and embarrassed. And because later I found out that originally I thought it was a real thing, and then later I found out, oh, no, I was conned. And I told it to a friend of mine feeling really stupid, And she said, you know what? You paid for really good theater. Yeah. So that's what we've done. We've paid for really good theater. And now let's get back to legislating and who we are and forget about it. Get that guy out of there and get moving. You know, get a real Republican in if we need to.
Yeah. Well,
I would prefer a Democrat, but in the interest of fair play, you know, at least get a real Republican in.
Yeah, understandably. Sorry, I feel like there's someone out there circling the block.
Oh, I don't know, you have
a parting gift. I got something for you.
Thank you so much.
Isn't going to be good radio. It's not going to be good podcasting because opening something isn't.
I'm going to open a present.
You can open it right now.
Here's the thing. I like to it's wrapped in a San Francisco Chronicle paper from the 1958?
1958. That's the second Giants game. That it's wrapped in.
Wow.
That's just what I had lying around. Sorry.
I like it. It says, doctor's wife. This is a headline. Doctor's wife has quads in East Bay.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means. I'm hoping it means the muscles. So I'm opening the... I see someone I recognize.
There you go.
Wow. That is nice. It's a picture of me on stage at the other cafe when I was 10. I'll give you a sense of when it is.
Uh-huh.
The shoulder pads on this jacket, I remember this jacket. The shoulder pads on this jacket are so huge, they obscure the neon other cafe comedy showcase sign.
Yeah.
Well, that is so sweet of you. Thank you very
much. Well, I wanted you to have a copy. You just signed one on our wall. And I've had other comics in here, and when they talk about the other cafe, I've had this happen twice now. They start mentioning you. Proops and Durst have both like associate you with the other cafe.
It was a big part of how I learned to do what I do. I think it was really the first place where I finally said to myself, it doesn't matter that I can't remember anything anymore.
Yeah.
I'll say what I think of. And made that okay for myself. Whereas before, I felt like a failure every time I couldn't remember stuff. And I've always had this. My son, when he was little, he said to me, you're like Dory. And he was right. I have a problem with my memory.
Yeah.
Well, that is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Welcome back. I hope you have a great show at the Norris/Sydney Goldstein Theater. New Year's Eve, one show. And I hope you come back again next year. I hope this is like just like an annual thing.
Oh,
you'll be my first third guest.
I love that idea. Thank you so much. Don't do anybody else as a third guest before me.
I won't.
I feel a little territorial now.
Yeah, you have that promise.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Darling, it's 2 a.m. It's time for closing. They're all sideways, and I think Aaron's broken home.
You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to my guest Paula Poundstone. This episode was produced by me, Peter Hartlob. Senior producer is King Kaufman, executive producer Tim O'Rourke, and our editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. Our music is The Tide Will Rise by the Sunset Shipwrecks off their album Community. Read our columns and subscribe to The Chronicle at www.sfchronicle.com. Chronicle podcasts are on Apple Podcasts and other streaming services.